Welcome to the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a podcast exclusively for members of the Quilt Fiction Story Guild. I'm Frances O'Rourke Dowell, and we're reading my work in progress friendship album, 1934. Thank you for joining us, and as always, thank you for being part of the Quilt Fiction community. Now, on to the story. Chapter 24. When she went with Hannah and Alice on Saturday to see the progress being made on Alice's new school, Dorothy had some difficulty believing that once upon a time, and not so long ago, a colored family had inhabited the large rooms with their high ceilings, elegant windows, and multiple fireplaces. This was not her first trip to Snob Hill, where most of Milton Falls' wealthy colored families lived, but it was the first time a door had been opened to her, and Dorothy was having a hard time taking it all in. "Mama needs to see this," she told Hannah, as Alice skipped off to explore the house's rambling interiors. "If I'm having a hard time believing colored folks lived here, she's going to find it downright impossible." Hannah opened her mouth to say something, her expression suggesting she was going to protest that once again Dorothy was behind the times or, at the very least, lacked imagination. But then she smiled and shook her head. "I remember the first time I went to play at Josie Shepherd's house. I thought I was going to faint. I always thought our house was the most beautiful house in the world, with all your quilts and your fancy china teacups with the roses on them. When I stepped into Josie's house, well, it was like entering a castle. It was a whole other country. I still like our house better, but no one would mistake it for a royal palace." Dorothy followed Hannah into what was once the living room. Now, four rows of four desks had been screwed into the honeyed hardwoods. "Do you think Alice is old enough to drink from one of your fancy teacups?" Hannah asked, running her hand over a desktop, shiny and new, nothing like the scarred desks in the school where she worked. "She sure is getting grown up." "Maybe we'll have a tea party to celebrate her coming to such a fine school," Dorothy suggested. "It's good to have ceremonies to celebrate special occasions." "Oh, Alice would like that," Hannah agreed. "What would I like?" Alice asked eagerly from the doorway. "You know I like all kinds of things." "We're talking about having a tea party," Dorothy told her, "using some of my fancy teacups." "The day before school starts," Hannah added. She turned to Dorothy. "Which will also be the day you quit that cleaning job, so there will be two things to celebrate." Dorothy nodded, although if truth be told, she wasn't sure the two things would go hand in hand as planned. Nina Tarkington was making progress, but it was slow progress. Getting the woman to focus on one task at a time took some doing. "I knew a lady like that back in Homerville," Eula had said when Dorothy had told her about the situation. "Mariah Ellison, the storekeeper's wife. You'd go in to buy a pound of coffee, and she'd be in the middle of weighing out your beans when it occurred to her that there was something else she needed to do, and it needed to be done right away. So off she'd scoot to whatever that thing was. Maybe it was that she needed to write up a bill, or she'd remembered somebody else was waiting for a pound of sugar. I found the only way to keep her doing what I needed her to do was to ask her what her pastor had preached about the week before. Mariah loved to complain about her preacher's sermons." Dorothy smiled, remembering the conversation. "That was one good thing about Nina Tarkington," she reckoned as she followed Hannah and Alice out of the classroom. Dorothy had heard Nina talk about all sorts of things. Lord knew that woman could talk. But she hadn't once heard her complain. Nina Tarkington seemed to know that she had things pretty good, even if she didn't know how to organize them.
"I didn't know you had fancy teacups,"
Alice said as she led her mother and Dorothy upstairs, where she'd spent the last few minutes exploring.
"Why haven't I ever seen them?"
"I keep them in a special place," Dorothy said. "They've been waiting for you to get old enough to drink from them." Alice considered this.
"I didn't know cups and plates could wait for things. Are they magic?"
"Maybe a little bit," Dorothy said. "Daddy Wallace's mother served tea in those cups the first time I was invited to their house, before Daddy Wallace and I were married. I remember that when I took a sip from one of those cups, I felt like a queen. So that was a little magic right there." Glancing at the staircase's graceful wrought iron railing, Dorothy could only imagine what her mother-in-law, who she'd referred to as Mrs. Johnson from the day she'd met the woman until the day Mrs. Johnson passed, would have made of this place. Wallace's mother had liked fine things, the kind of things she mostly couldn't afford as the wife of a mill worker. But she was a brilliant seamstress who could make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and heads turned when her three daughters made their way down the aisle Sunday mornings at the Allen Temple African Methodist Episcopal Church. The dresses they wore were suitably modest and understated, but they were also undeniably beautiful. It didn't hurt that Mrs. Johnson made dresses for some of the richest women in town, including the mayor's wife. She was frequently given their cast-off clothes, which she would refashion so that no one would guess they'd ever been worn before. Some of these she gave to her daughters, and others she sold on consignment at Mrs. Noreen Whitaker's popular dress shop on East Main Street. It was one of those refashioned dresses that had earned Mrs. Johnson's most prized possession— an 11-piece rose toile fine porcelain tea set that included one teapot, one sugar bowl, one creamer, and four cups with four saucers. She had coveted that tea set since she first laid eyes on it when she'd gone to fit Calliope Madigan for her wedding dress. Mrs. Madigan had led Mrs. Johnson, whom she called Sally, not thinking to dignify a colored woman by the use of an honorific, from the kitchen through the dining room to the parlor, where her daughter was waiting to be measured. There, on an elegant mahogany high board, sat the tea set in all of its glory. Mrs. Johnson had never seen anything so lovely. No matter that she and Mr. Johnson drank coffee, or that they had neither a parlor nor a high board, nor the leisure time one might need to enjoy a cup of tea. None of that mattered to Mrs. Johnson. What she wanted, she would tell Dorothy many years later, was the sort of elegance such a tea set would confer upon her home. She was the daughter of slaves who had fled north from Georgia as soon as they learned they'd been emancipated. Her mother, who herself had worked as a seamstress in her owner's house, had passed on her love of fine things to her daughter, and Mrs. Johnson imagined that owning such a tea set would please her mother, who had passed on many years before, but whose presence Mrs. Johnson often felt. However, Mrs. Johnson, though a woman of great imagination and feeling, was by no means foolish, and she knew that she had little chance of ever possessing an 11-piece rose toile fine porcelain tea set, especially not this 11-piece rose toile fine porcelain tea set. Still, she admired it whenever she came to the Madigan's house over the 2 months she was in their service. She knew that to covet was a sin, but surely God understood how much a woman loved beautiful things and would forgive her her trespasses. The dress she created for Calliope Madigan was a work of art. Calliope herself was a rather plain young woman, but when the cream-colored silk gauze with narrow opaque stripes and trimmed with cream silk, embroidered net, lace, was gently lowered over her head and shoulders and then fastened and belted and smoothed out, something bloomed from within, and the girl became as beautiful as any bride who ever walked down the aisle. Mrs. Madigan, thrilled, paid Mrs. Johnson $10 over the agreed price and, moreover, had delivered to the Johnson's house half a dozen of her daughter's dresses that Calliope no longer wore, as they were no longer fashionable. "Perhaps your daughters would enjoy these," the note said. While Mrs. Johnson's daughters would indeed enjoy those dresses, they had no place to wear them, and while Mrs. Johnson was adept at making a plain dress into a work of art, she didn't have the heart to tailor such beautiful dresses to make them acceptable for Sunday services at Allen Temple African and Methodist Episcopal Church, where dressing that far above one's station would not be well received. And so Mrs. Johnson took the dresses and made them new, and when she finished, they were as fresh and fashionable as if they'd only moments ago arrived on a ship from Paris. She wanted to show them to her daughters, but knew she'd never hear the end of it if she did. They'd fuss and cluck like a clutch of hens until she'd given them a dress apiece. But why give a dress to a girl who had no place to wear it? No, Mrs. Johnson thought it best to pack the dresses in her brown leather satchel and carry them over to Mrs. Whittaker's shop, where Mrs. Whittaker would sell them on consignment. Usually Mrs. Johnson was happy to take a 50-50 split with Mrs. Whittaker, but these dresses were different. She wanted 60-40, and she was ready to fight for it. Mrs. Whittaker, a shrewd businesswoman, knew when to push and when to settle, and when she saw the beautiful dresses that Mrs. Johnson had fashioned and heard the terms, she settled. "I'll sell them as new," she confided to Mrs. Johnson. "We'll both make a pretty penny." She then began writing out an agreement for each dress, a contract of sorts that stated how much Mrs. Whittaker would charge for the dress, and the dollar amount that Mrs. Johnson would receive after the dress was sold. She had made out agreements for 5 of the 6 dresses when the shop door opened and a customer was announced with the delicate tinkle of a bell. Mrs. Johnson looked up to see Mrs. Madigan, the recent mother of the bride. "Good morning, Mrs. Whittaker, and hello, Sally," she called, and then she crossed the room to where Mrs. Whittaker and Mrs. Johnson were doing business. The 6 dresses were laid out on the counter, and only a woman completely inured to the beauty of this world wouldn't have felt her heart skip a beat. "Why, Sally, are these your creations? They're stunning." Mrs. Johnson wasn't exactly sure how to reply. Yes, these were her creations, in a manner of speaking. In another manner of speaking, however, they were Mrs. Madigan's old clothes that Mrs. Johnson was about to make a tidy sum on. How long did it take Mrs. Madigan to realize these were her dresses, only reconstructed and reimagined into works of art? When Mrs. Johnson told this story to Dorothy, which she liked to do at least once a year, the length of time differed. In some tellings, it was a matter of moments. In others, Mrs. Madigan strolled around the shop, remarking upon this dress and then that one, until her eyes lit up with the truth of the situation, and she returned to the counter to reclaim what was rightfully hers. "I gave these dresses to you as a gift," she told Mrs. Johnson, and then turned to Mrs. Whittaker. "If she didn't want these dresses, she should have returned them. Why, my daughter would look perfectly charming in any one of them. Instead, Sally is trying to profit off of my generosity." It would be many years, decades even, where a woman like Mrs. Johnson would have the temerity to speak back to a woman like Mrs. Madigan. It wasn't just that Mrs. Madigan might badmouth her to all of her rich white lady friends, cutting off Mrs. Johnson's main source of income. The woman might also go to the mill boss and demand that Mr. Johnson be fired. Knowing this, Mrs. Johnson kept her mouth shut. Mrs. Whittaker, on the other hand, did not. While known to be a shrewd businesswoman and a hard bargainer, Mrs. Whittaker also had a surprisingly soft heart, a fact she did her best to hide while dealing with wholesalers. But she liked Mrs. Johnson and recognized her as a fellow lover of beauty. Moreover, Mrs. Johnson could have opened her own dress shop if she'd wanted to, and not one woman in Milton Falls would have cared if she was colored or white or purple and polka-dotted. They would have raced to buy her dresses. Mrs. Madigan, surely you recognize that you wouldn't think twice on the matter if Mrs. Johnson had not done such a magisterial job on refashioning the dresses, which no doubt were of the highest quality to begin with. You were happy to let these dresses go, and wouldn't have cared a whit what happened to them if Sally hadn't remade them. Isn't that the case? Mrs. Madigan thought for a moment and then gave a reluctant nod. I suppose so. I've written up notes for all but one of these dresses, Mrs. Whittaker continued, pointing to the last dress in the row, arguably the most beautiful. I'm willing to let the sale go, should you care to buy the dress directly from Sally.
But that makes no sense, Mrs. Madigan protested. Pay good money for a dress that I've already paid for?
Surely you understand my reasoning, Mrs. Whittaker pushed back. You wouldn't want this dress if Sally hadn't made it over. Sally, what would you charge if Mrs. Madigan had paid you to tailor this dress to new specifications instead of giving it to you?
Mrs. Johnson thought long and hard on the matter. She had taken the dress apart and sewn it back together, only this time with flounces and a lace collar, pearl buttons, and a silk netting overlay. She'd all but made it from scratch.
$25, she said, her voice firm, knowing the price to be outrageously high.
Why, I could practically buy a new house for $25, Mrs. Madigan exclaimed.
Not one so fine as your house, Mrs. Whittaker soothed her. Besides, surely you've spent $25 on a dress before, Mrs. Madigan, and I suspect it wasn't half as beautiful as this one.
Mrs. Madigan gave a firm shake of the head. I simply can't do it, she said. But Mrs. Johnson saw her glance longingly at the dress, the same way Mrs. Johnson so often gazed at the rose-toile tea set. Perhaps I could give it to you, Mrs. Johnson said, and to no one's surprise, Mrs. Madigan's eyes lit up like candles. And, in return, you could give something to me. As it turned out, Mrs. Madigan had never been all that fond of her 11-piece rose-toile tea set, which had been a wedding present from her mother-in-law. But the elder Mrs. Madigan had passed away the summer before, and the younger, though not especially young, Mrs. Madigan was sure no one would notice if she replaced one tea set for another. I've had my eye on a Lamage's tea set for ever so long, Mrs. Madigan said cheerfully as Mrs. Whittaker wrapped up the dress. This will give me the perfect excuse. If anyone asks, I'll just say that the maid broke the pitcher while she was dusting. Mrs. Johnson had found the last remark distressing, especially as she had become friendly with Mrs. Whittaker's maid while working on the wedding gown. Still, Mr. Madigan, being a man, would probably never notice. The tea set was delivered to the Johnsons' home the next morning. Mrs. Johnson set it out on the old oak dresser in her bedroom, where her children were not allowed entrance. If they were very well behaved at church, she might let them come in to look at it before Sunday dinner. Though only her daughters had very much interest after the first time. Her sons, Wallace, Lucas, and Philip, had been satisfied that one look would do them for years to come. Dorothy had always stood a little bit in awe of her mother-in-law. She was a country girl, after all, who'd been 15 when she'd moved to town, and her in-laws were sophisticated city folk. But Mrs. Johnson had always been cordial to her, and over the years seemed to develop an actual fondness for her. "She likes you better than them other gals," Wallace had told Dorothy once, referring to Mrs. Johnson's other daughters-in-law. "That's because you stand up to her, but you do it in a polite way." The 11-piece rose toile tea set had kept its home on Mrs. Johnson's dresser for 40 years, brought out only on special occasions. When Mrs. Johnson passed, they found a note in the cream pitcher. The set was to be divided, the teapot to this daughter, the cream pitcher to that one. Dorothy was given 2 cups, the only daughter-in-law to receive anything. "What'd I tell you?" Wallace had asked. "You always were her favorite." Alice skipped around the art room with its north wall, floor-to-ceiling windows. "Mama says we're going to paint and make cups out of clay. Isn't that right, Mama?" "That's right," Hannah said. "And you're to wear a smock when you do. I'm going to make you one when I get a minute. It won't take but an evening." "I'll make the girl a smock," Dorothy said. "I've got some pretty fabric that will be just right. It's got a busy print that will hide any spots or splatters."
"Oh, you're too busy to do that, Mama," Hannah said.
"You're busy too," Dorothy countered. "Besides, I want to. I like the idea that Alice will come to school and make beautiful things. That should be part of any child's education."
"I agree," Hannah said. "Oh, Mama, I'm so excited about this school. It's going to be the best thing in the world for Alice, for all of my babies."
"It's 2 months until school starts," Alice said as she skipped back toward them. "Maybe we ought to practice having tea parties now.
I'd need to learn how to sip tea the proper way from those cups of yours."
"Maybe," Dorothy told her, remembering the first time she'd lifted one of those cups to her lips, thinking how she'd never held such a beautiful thing so close.
Thanks for joining us on the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast. We're reading Friendship Album 1934, a novel by Frances O'Rourke Dow, a production of Milton Falls Media, Incorporated. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved. Until next time, this is Frances O'Rourke Dow. Thank you for joining us.